eye-watering shards of hot light. There was nothing there to look at, but Ace wanted to look anyway. He started across the street. He had almost reached the far side when the green awning two storefronts up caught his eye. Needful Things, the side of the awning read. Now, what kind of a name for a store was that? Ace walked up the street to see. He could look at the vacant lot where his uncle's tourist trap had stood later on. He didn't think anyone was going to move it. The first thing to catch his eye was the Help Wanted sign. He paid it little attention. He didn't know what he had come back to Castle Rock for, but a stock boy job wasn't it. There were a number of rather classy-looking items in the window, the sort of stuff he would have taken away if he were doing a little night work in some rich guy's house. A chess set with carved jungle animals for pieces, a necklace of black pearls. It looked valuable to Ace, but he supposed the pearls were probably artificial. Surely no one in this dipshit burg could afford a string of genuine black pearls. Good job, though. They looked real enough to him, and Ace looked at the book behind the pearls with narrowed eyes. It had been set up on its spine so someone looking in the window could easily see the cover, which depicted the silhouettes of two men standing on a ridge at night. One had a pick, the other a shovel. They appeared to be digging a hole. The title of the book was Lost and Buried Treasures of New England. The author's name was printed below the picture in small white letters. It was Reginald Merrill. Ace went to the door and tried the knob. It turned easily. The bell overhead jingled. Ace Merrill entered Needful Things. No, Ace said, looking at the book Mr. Gaughan had taken from the window display and put into his hands. This isn't the one I want. You must have gotten the wrong one. It's the only book in the show window, I assure you, Mr. Gaunt said in a mildly puzzled voice. You can look for yourself if you don't believe me. For a moment, Ace did almost that, and then he let out an exasperated little sigh. No, that's okay, he said. The book the shopkeeper had handed him was Treasure Island by Robert Louis Stevenson. What had happened was clear enough. He'd had Pop on his mind, and he'd made a mistake. The real mistake, though, had been coming back to Castle Rock in the first place. Why in the fuck had he done it? Listen, this is a very interesting place you've got here, but I ought to get a move on. I'll see you another time, Mr. Gaunt, the shopkeeper said, putting out his hand. Leland Gaunt. Ace put his own hand out, and it was swallowed up. A great galvanizing power seemed to rush through him at the moment of contact. His mind was filled with that dark blue light again, a huge, sheeting flare of it this time. He took his hand back, dazed and weak-kneed. What was that? He whispered. I believe they call it an attention-getter, Mr. Gaunt said. He spoke with quiet composure. You'll want to pay attention to me, Mr. Merrill. How did you know my name? I didn't tell you my name. Oh, I know who you are, Mr. Gaunt said with a little laugh. I've been expecting you. How could you be expecting me? I didn't even know I was coming until I got in the damn car. Excuse me for a moment, please. Gaunt stepped back toward the window, bent, and picked up a sign which was leaning against the wall. Then he leaned into the window, removed Help Wanted, and put up Closed Columbus Day in its place. Why'd you do that? Ace felt like a man who has stumbled into a wire fence with a moderate electric charge running through it. It's customary for shopkeepers to remove Help Wanted signs when they have filled the vacant position, Mr. Gaunt said a little severely. My business in Castle Rock has grown at a very satisfying rate, and I now find I need a strong back and an extra pair of hands. I tire so easily these days. Hey, I also need a driver, Mr. Gaunt said. Driving is, I believe, your main skill. Your first job, Ace, will be to drive to Boston. I have an automobile parked in a garage there. It will amuse you. It's a Tucker. A Tucker? For a moment, Ace forgot that he hadn't come to town to take a stock boy's job, or a chauffeur's either, for that matter. You mean like in that movie? Not exactly, Mr. Gaunt said. He walked behind the counter, where his old-fashioned cash register stood, produced a key, and unlocked the drawer beneath. He took out two small envelopes. One of them he laid on the counter, the other he held out to Ace. It's been modified in some ways. Here, the keys. Hey, now, wait a minute. I told you. Mr. Gaunt's eyes were some strange color Ace could not quite pick up. But when they first darkened and then blazed out at him, Ace felt his knees grow watery again. You're in a jam, Ace. But if you don't stop behaving like an ostrich with its head stuck in the sand, I believe I'm going to lose interest in helping you. Shop assistants are a dime a dozen. I know. Believe me, I've hired hundreds of them over the years, perhaps thousands. So stop fucking around and take the keys. Ace took the little envelope. As the tips of his fingers touched the tips of Mr. Gaunt's, that dark, sheeting fire filled his head once more. He moaned. You'll drive your car to the address I give you, Mr. Gaunt said, and park it in the space where mine is now stored. I'll expect you back by midnight at the latest. I think it will actually be a good deal earlier than that. My car is much faster than it looks. He grinned, revealing all those teeth. Ace tried again. Listen, Mr. Gaunt. Ace nodded, his head bobbing up and down like the head of a marionette controlled by a novice puppet master. Under other circumstances, I'd take you up on it. You're interesting. It wasn't the word he wanted, but it was the best one he could wrap his tongue around for the time being. But you were right. I am in a jackpot, and if I don't find a large chunk of cash in the next 2 weeks... Well, what about the book? Mr. Gaunt asked. His tone was both amused and reproving. Isn't that why you came in? It isn't what I... He discovered he was still holding it in his hand and looked down at it again. The picture was the same, but the title had changed back to what he had seen in the show window, Lost and Buried Treasures of New England, by Reginald Merrill. What is this? He asked thickly, but suddenly he knew. He wasn't in Castle Rock at all. He was at home in Mechanic Falls, lying in his own dirty bed, dreaming all this. It looks like a book to me, Mr. Gaunt said. And wasn't your late uncle's name Reginald Merrill? What a coincidence. My uncle never wrote anything but receipts and IOUs in his whole life, Ace said in that same thick, sleepy voice. He looked up at Gaunt again and found he could not pull his eyes away. Gaunt's eyes kept changing color. Blue, gray, hazel, brown, black. Well, Mr. Gaunt admitted, perhaps the name on the book is a pseudonym. Perhaps I wrote that particular tome myself. You? Mr. Gaunt steepled his fingers under his chin. Perhaps it isn't even a book at all. Perhaps all the really special things I sell aren't what they appear to be. Perhaps they are actually gray things with only one remarkable property, the ability to take the shapes of those things which haunt the dreams of men and women. He paused, then added thoughtfully, perhaps they are dreams themselves. I don't get any of this. Mr. Gaunt smiled. I know. It doesn't matter. If your uncle had written a book, Ace, mightn't it have been about buried treasure? Wouldn't you say the treasure, whether buried in the ground or in the pockets of his fellow men, was a subject which greatly interested him? He liked money, all right, Ace said grimly. Well, what happened to it? Mr. Gaunt cried. Did he leave any of it to you? Surely he did. Are you not his only surviving relative? He didn't leave me a red fucking cent, Ace yelled back furiously. Everyone in town said the old bastard had the first dime he ever made, but there was less than $4,000 in his bank accounts when he died. That went to bury him and clean up the mess he left down street. And when they opened his safe deposit box, do you know what they found? Yes, Mr. Gaunt said, and although his mouth was serious, even sympathetic, his eyes were laughing. Trading stamps, 6 books of plaid stamps, and 14 of gold bond stamps. That's right, Ace said. He looked balefully down at lost and buried treasures of New England. His disquiet and his sense of dreamy disorientation had been swallowed, at least for the time being, by his rage. And you know what? You can't even redeem gold bond stamps anymore. The company went out of business. Everyone in Castle Rock was afraid of him. Even I was a little afraid of him. And everyone thought he was as rich as Scrooge McFucking Duck, but he died broke. Maybe he didn't trust banks, Mr. Gaunt said. Maybe he buried his treasure. Do you think that's possible, Ace? Ace opened his mouth, closed it, opened it, closed it. Stop that, said Mr. Gaunt. You look like a fish in an aquarium. Ace looked at the book in his hand. He put it on the counter and riffled through the pages, which were crammed tight with small print. And something breezed out. It was a large and ragged chunk of brown paper, unevenly folded, and he recognized it at once. It had been torn from a Hemp Hills Market shopping bag. How often, as a little boy, had he watched his uncle tear off a piece of brown paper just like this one from one of the bags he kept under his ancient Tokheim cash register? How many times had he watched him add up figures on such a scrap, or write an IOU on it? He unfolded it with shaking hands. It was a map. That much was clear, but at first he could make nothing of it. It was just a bunch of lines and crosses and squiggly circles. What the fuck? You need something to focus your concentration, that's all, Mr. Gaunt said. This might help. Ace looked up. Mr. Gaunt had put a small mirror in an ornate silver frame on the glass case beside his own cash register. Now he opened the other envelope he had taken from the locked drawer and spilled a generous quantity of cocaine onto the mirror's surface. To Ace's non-inexperienced eye, it looked to be of fabulously high quality. The spotlight over the display case kicked thousands of little sparkles from the clean flakes. Jesus, mister! Ace's nose began to tingle in anticipation. Is that Colombian? No, this is a special hybrid, Mr. Gaunt said. It comes from the plains of Ling. He took a gold letter opener from the inside pocket of his fawn jacket and began to organize the pile of blow into long, chubby lines. Where's that? Over the hills and far away, Mr. Gaunt replied without looking up. Don't ask questions, Ace. Men who owe money do well to simply enjoy the good things which come their way. He put the letter opener back and drew a short glass straw from the same pocket. He handed it to Ace. Be my guest. The straw was amazingly heavy, not glass after all, but some sort of rock crystal, Ace guessed. He bent over the mirror, then hesitated. What if the old guy had AIDS or something like that? Don't ask questions, Ace. Men who owe money do well to simply enjoy the good things which come their way. Amen, Ace said aloud and tooted up. His head filled with that vague banana-lemon taste that really good cocaine always seemed to have. It was mellow, but it was also powerful. He felt his heart begin to pound. At the same time, his thoughts grew sharply focused and took on a polished chromium edge. He remembered something a guy had told him not long after he fell in love with this stuff. Things have more names when you're coked up. A lot more names. He hadn't understood then, but he thought he did now. He offered the straw to Gaunt, but Gaunt shook his head. Never before five, he said, but you enjoy, Ace. Thanks, Ace said. He looked at the map again and found that he could now read it perfectly. The two parallel lines with the X between them was clearly the Tin Bridge, and once you realized that, everything else fell neatly into place. The squiggle which ran between the lines, through the X, and up to the top of the paper was Route 117. The small circle with the larger circle behind it must represent the Gavino Dairy Farm. The big circle would be the cow barn. It all made sense. It was as clear and clean and sparkly as the crisp heap of dope this incredibly hip dude had poured out of the little envelope. Ace bent over the mirror again. Fire when ready, he murmured, and took another two lines. Bang! Zap! Christ, that's powerful stuff, he said in a gasping voice. Show enough, Mr. Gaunt agreed gravely. Ace looked up, suddenly sure the man was laughing at him, but Mr. Gaunt's face was calm and clear. Ace bent over the map again. Now it was the crosses which caught his eye. There were seven of them. No, actually, there were eight. One appeared to be on the dead, swampy ground owned by Old Man Treblehorn. Except Old Man Treblehorn was dead, had been for years, and hadn't there been talk at one time that his Uncle Reginald had gotten most of that land as repayment of a loan? Here was another, on the edge of the Nature Conservancy on the other side of Castle View, if he had his geography right. There were two out on Town Road Number 3, near a circle that was probably the old Joe Camber place, Seven Oaks Farm. Two more on the land supposedly owned by Diamond Match on the west side of Castle Lake. Ace stared up at Gaunt with wild, bloodshot eyes. Did he bury his money? Is that what the crosses mean? Are they the places he buried his money? Mr. Gaunt shrugged elegantly. I'm sure I don't know. It seems logical, but logic often has little to do with the way people behave. But it could be, Ace said. He was becoming frantic with excitement and cocaine overload. What felt like stiff bundles of copper wire were exploding in the big muscles of his arms and belly. His sallow face, pocked with the scars of adolescent acne, had taken on a dark flush. It could be. All the places those crosses are, all that could be Pop's property. Do you see? He might have put all that land in a blind trust, or whatever the fuck they call it, so nobody could buy it, so nobody could find what he put there. He snorted the rest of the coke on the mirror and then leaned over the counter. His bulging, bloodshot eyes jittered in his face. I could be more than just out of the shithole, he said in a low, trembling whisper. I could be fucking rich. Yes, Mr. Gaunt said. I'd say that's a good possibility. But remember that, Ace. He cocked his thumb toward the wall and the sign there which read, I do not issue refunds or make exchanges. Caveat emptor. Ace looked at the sign. What's it mean? It means that you're not the first person who ever thought he had found the key to great riches in an old book, Mr. Gaunt said. It also means that I still need a stock boy and a chauffeur. Ace looked at him, almost shocked. Then he laughed. You kidding? He pointed at the map. I've got a lot of digging to do. Mr. Gaunt sighed regretfully, folded the sheet of brown paper, put it back into the book, and replaced the book in the drawer under the cash register. He did all this with incredible swiftness. Hey! Ace yelled. What are you doing? I just remembered that book is already promised to another customer, Mr. Merrill. I'm sorry, and I really am closed. It's Columbus Day, you know. Wait a minute! Of course, if you had seen fit to take the job, I'm sure something could have been worked out. But I can see you're very busy. You undoubtedly want to make sure your affairs are in order before the Corson brothers turn you into cold cuts. Ace's mouth had begun to open and close again. He was trying to remember where the little crosses had been, and was discovering that he couldn't do it. All of them seemed to blend together into one big cross in his jazzed-up, flying mind, the sort of cross you saw in cemeteries. All right, he cried. All right, I'll take the fucking job. In that case, I believe this book is for sale after all, Mr. Gaunt said. He drew it out of the drawer and checked the flyleaf. It goes for $1.50. His jostling teeth appeared in a wide, sharky smile. That's $1.35, with the employee discount. Ace drew his wallet from his back pocket, dropped it, and almost clouted his head on the edge of the glass case, bending over to pick it up. But I've got to have some time off, he told Mr. Gaunt. Indeed. Because I really do have some digging to do.
Of course.
Time is short.
How wise of you to know it.
How about when I get back from Boston?
Won't you be tired?
Mr. Gaunt, I can't afford to be tired.
I might be able to help you there, Mr. Gaunt said.
His smile widened and his teeth bulged from it like the teeth of a skull. I might have a little pick-me-up for you is what I mean to say.
What?
Ace asked, his eyes widening. What did you say?
I beg your pardon?
Nothing, Ace said. Never mind.
All right. Do you still have the keys I gave you?
Ace was surprised to discover he had stuffed the envelope containing the keys into his back pocket. Good. Mr. Gaunt rang up $1.35 on the old register, took the $5 bill Ace had laid on the counter, and rendered $3.65 change. Ace took it like a man in a dream. Now, Mr. Gaunt said, let me give you a few directions, Ace, and remember what I said. I want you back by midnight. If you're not back by midnight, I will be unhappy. When I'm unhappy, I sometimes lose my temper. You wouldn't want to be around when that happens.
Do you hulk out? Ace asked jestingly.
Mr. Gaunt looked up with a grinning ferocity that caused Ace to retreat a step. Yes, he said. That's just what I do, Ace. I hulk out. Indeed I do. Now pay attention. Ace paid attention. It was 10:45, and Alan was just getting ready to go down to Nan's and catch a quick cup of coffee when Sheila Brigham buzzed him. It was Sonny Jacket on line one, she said. He insisted on talking to Alan and nobody else. Alan picked up the phone. Hello, Sonny. What can I do for you?
Well, Sonny said in his drawling Down East accent, I hate to put more trouble on your plate after the double helping you got yesterday, Chef, but I think an old friend of yours is back in town.
Who's that?
Ace Merrill. I seen his car parked up street from here.
Oh, shit. What next? Alan thought. Did you see him?
No, but you can't miss the car. Puke green Dodge Challenger, what the kids call a ramrod. I seen it up to the plains.
Well, thanks, Sonny.
Don't mention it. What do you suppose that booger's doing back in Castle Rock, Alan?
I don't know, Alan said, and thought as he hung up, but I guess I better find out. There was a space empty next to the green Challenger. Alan swung Unit 1 in next to it and got out. He saw Bill Fullerton and Henry Gendron looking out the barbershop window at him with bright-eyed interest and raised a hand to them. Henry pointed across the street. Alan nodded and crossed. Wilma Jerzyk and Nettie Cobb kill each other on a street corner one day, and Ace Merrill turns up the next, he thought. This town's turning into Barnum and Bailey's Circus. As he reached the sidewalk on the far side, he saw Ace come sauntering out of the shadow cast by the green awning of Needful Things. He had something in one hand. At first, Alan couldn't tell what it was, but as Ace drew closer, he decided he had been able to tell. He just hadn't been able to believe it. Ace Merrill just wasn't the sort of guy you expected to see with a book in his hand. They drew together in front of the vacant lot where the Emporium Glorium had once stood. Hello, Ace, Alan said. Ace didn't seem in the least surprised to see him. He took his sunglasses from the V of his shirt, shook them out one-handed, and slipped them on.
Well, well, well. How they hanging, boss?
What are you doing in Castle Rock, Ace? Alan asked evenly. Ace looked up at the sky with exaggerated interest. Little glints of light twinkled on the lenses of his Ray-Bans. Nice day for a ride, he said. Summery.
Very nice, Alan agreed. Have you got a valid license, Ace?
Ace looked at him reproachfully. Would I be out driving if I didn't? That wouldn't be legal, would it?
I don't think that's an answer.
I took the re-exam as soon as they gave me my pink sheet, Ace said. I'm street legal. How's that, boss? Is that an answer?
Maybe I could check it for myself. Alan held out his hand.
Why, I don't think you trust me, Ace said. He spoke in the same jocular, teasing voice, but Alan heard the anger beneath it.
Let's just say I'm from Missouri.
Ace shifted the book to his left hand so he could dig the wallet out of his hip pocket with his right, and Alan got a better look at the cover. The book was Treasure Island by Robert Louis Stevenson. He looked at the license. It was signed and valid. The car registration is in the glove compartment if you want to cross the street and look at that, too, Ace said. Alan could hear the anger in his voice more clearly now, and the old arrogance as well.
I think I'll trust you on that one, Ace. Why don't you tell me what you're really doing back here in town?
I came to look at that, Ace said, and pointed to the vacant lot. I don't know why, but I did. I doubt if you believe me, but it happens to be the truth.
Oddly enough, Alan did believe him.
I see you bought a book, too. I can read, Ace said. I doubt if you believe that either.
Well, well. Alan hooked his thumbs into his belt and looked at Ace. You had a look, and you bought a book.
He's a poet, and he don't know it.
Why, I guess I am. It's good of you to point it out, Ace. Now, I guess you'll be sliding on out of town, won't you?
What if I don't? You'd find something to bust me for, I guess. Is the word rehabilitation in your vocabulary, Sheriff Pangborn?
Yes, Alan said, but the definition isn't Ace Merrill.
You don't want to push me, man.
I'm not. If I start, you'll know it.
Ace took off his sunglasses.
You guys never quit, do you? You never fucking quit.
Alan said nothing. After a moment, Ace seemed to regain his composure. He put his Ray-Bans back on.
You know, he said, I think I will leave. I've got places to go and things to do.
That's good. Busy hands are happy hands.
But if I want to come back, I will. Do you hear me?
I hear you, Ace, and I want to tell you that I don't think that would be wise at all.
Do you hear me?
You don't scare me.
If I don't, Alan said, you're even dumber than I thought.
Ace looked at Alan for a moment through his dark glasses, then laughed. Alan didn't care for the sound of it. It was a creepy sort of laugh, strange and off-center. He stood and watched as Ace crossed the street in his outdated hood strut, opened the door of his car, and got in. A moment later, the engine roared into life. Exhaust blatted through the straight pipes. People stopped on the street to look. That's an illegal muffler, Alan thought, a glass pack. I could cite him for that. But what would be the point? He had bigger fish to fry than Ace Merrill, who was leaving town anyway. For good this time, he hoped. He watched the green Challenger make an illegal U-turn on Main Street and head back toward Castle Stream and the edge of town. Then he turned and looked thoughtfully up the street at the green awning. Ace had come back to his old hometown and bought a book, Treasure Island, to be exact. He had bought it in Needful Things. I thought that place was closed today, Alan thought. Wasn't that what the sign said? He walked up the street to Needful Things. He had not been wrong about the sign. It read, Closed Columbus Day. If he'll see Ace, maybe he'll see me, Alan thought, and raised his fist to knock. Before he could bring it down, the pager, clipped to his belt, went off. Alan pushed the button that turned the hateful gadget off and stood indecisively in front of the shop door a moment longer. But there was really no question about what he had to do now. If you were a lawyer or a business executive, maybe you could afford to ignore your pages for a while. But when you were a county sheriff, and one who was elected rather than appointed, there wasn't much question about priorities. Alan crossed the sidewalk, then paused and spun around quickly. He felt a little like the player who is it in a game of red light, the one whose job it is to catch the other players in motion so he can send them all the way back to the beginning. The feeling that he was being watched had returned, and it was very strong. He was positive he would see the surprised twitch of the drawn shades on Mr. Gaunt's side of the door. But there was nothing. The shop just went on dozing in the unnaturally hot October sunlight, and if he hadn't seen Ace coming out with his own eyes, Alan would have sworn the place was empty, watched feeling or no watched feeling. He crossed to his cruiser, leaned in to grab the mic, and radioed in. Henry Payton called, Sheila told him. He's already got preliminary reports on Nettie Cobb and Wilma Jerzyk from Henry Ryan. Bye? I copy. Bye. Henry said if you want him to give you the high spots, he'll be in from right now until about noon. Bye. Okay, I'm just up Main Street. I'll be right in. Bye. Alan? Yeah? Henry also asked if we're going to get a fax machine before the turn of the century so we can just send copies of this stuff instead of calling all the time and reading it to you. Bye. Tell him to write a letter to the head selectman, Alan said grumpily. I'm not the one who writes the budget, and he knows it. Well, I'm just telling you what he said. No need to get all huffy about it. Bye. Alan thought Sheila sounded rather huffy herself, however. Over and out, he said. He got into Unit 1 and racked the mic. He glanced at the bank in time to see the big digital readout over the door announce the time is 10:50 and the temperature is 82 degrees. Jesus, we don't need this, he thought. Everyone in town's got a goddamn case of prickly heat. Alan drove slowly back to the municipal building, lost in thought. He couldn't shake the feeling that there was something going on in Castle Rock, something which was on the verge of slipping out of control. It was crazy, of course, crazy as hell, but he just couldn't shake it. The town schools were closed for the holiday, but Brian Rusk wouldn't have gone even if they had been open. Brian was sick. It wasn't any kind of physical illness, not measles or chicken pox or even the Hershey squirts, the most humiliating and debilitating of them all. Nor was it a mental disease, exactly. His mind was involved, all right, but it felt almost as if that involvement were a side effect. The part of him which had taken sick was deeper inside him than his mind. Some essential part of his makeup, which was available to no doctor's needle or microscope, had gone gray and ill. He had always been a sunshiny sort of boy, but that sun was gone now, buried behind heavy banks of cloud, which were still building. The clouds had begun to gather on the afternoon he had thrown the mud at Wilma Jerzyk's sheets. They had thickened when Mr. Gaunt had come to him in a dream, dressed in a Dodger uniform, and told him he wasn't done paying for his Sandy Koufax card yet. But the overcast had not become total until he had come down to breakfast this morning. His father, dressed in the gray fatigues he wore to work at the Dick Perry Siding and Door Company in South Paris, was seated at the kitchen table with the Portland Press Herald open in front of him. "Goddamn patriots," he said from behind his newspaper barricade. "When the hell are they going to get a quarterback that can throw the goddamn ball?" "Don't swear in front of the boys," Cora said from the stove, but she didn't speak with her usual exasperated forcefulness. She sounded distant and preoccupied. Brian slipped into his chair and poured milk on his cornflakes. "Hey, Bri," Sean said cheerfully. "You want to go downtown today? Play some video games?" "Maybe," Brian said. "I guess..." Then he saw the headline on the front page of the paper and stopped talking. "Murderous spat leaves two women dead in Castle Rock. It was a duel," state police source claims. There were photographs of two women, side by side. Brian recognized both of them. One was Nettie Cobb, who lived around the corner on Ford Street. His mom said she was a nut, but she had always seemed okay to Brian. He had stopped a couple of times to pet her dog when she was walking him, and she seemed pretty much like anyone else. The other woman was Wilma Jerzyk. He poked at his cereal, but didn't actually eat any of it. After his father left for work, Brian dumped the soggy cornflakes into the garbage pail and then crept upstairs to his room. He expected his mother to come cawing after him, asking how come he was throwing away good food while children were starving in Africa. She seemed to believe the thought of starving kids could improve your appetite. But she didn't. She seemed lost in a world of her own this morning. Sean was right there, however, bugging him, just like always. "So what do you say, Bri? You want to go downtown? Do you?" He was almost dancing from one foot to the other in his excitement. "We could play some video games, maybe check out that new store with all the neat stuff in the window." "You stay out of there!" Brian shouted, and his little brother recoiled, a look of shock and dismay spreading over his face. "Hey," Brian said, "I'm sorry, but you don't want to go in there, Sean-o. That place sucks." Sean's lower lip was trembling. "Kevin Pelkey says..." "Who are you going to believe? That wet end of your own brother? It's no good, Sean, it's..." He wet his lips and then said what he understood as the bottom of the truth. "It's bad." "What's the matter with you?" Sean asked. His voice was fierce and teary. "You've been acting like a dope all weekend. Mom, too." "I don't feel so good, that's all." "Well..." Sean considered. Then he brightened. "Maybe some video games would make you feel better. We can play Air Raid, Bri. They got Air Raid. The one where you sit right inside and it tilts back and forth. It's awesome." Brian considered it briefly. No, he couldn't imagine going down to the video arcade. Not today. Maybe not ever again. All the other kids would be there. Today you'd have to wait in line to get at the good games like Air Raid. But he was different from them now, and he might always be different. After all, he had a 1956 Sandy Koufax card. Still, he wanted to do something nice for Sean, for anyone, something that would make up a little for the monstrous thing he had done to Wilma Jerzyk. So he told Sean he might want to play some video games that afternoon, but to take some quarters in the meantime. Brian shook them out of his big plastic Coke bottle bank. "Jeepers," Sean said, his eyes round. "There's 8, 9, 10 quarters here. You really must be sick." "Yeah, I guess I must be. Have fun, Sean-o, and don't tell Mom or she'll make you put them back." "She's in her room, mooning around in those dark glasses," Sean said. "She doesn't even know we're alive." He paused for a moment and then added, "I hate those dark glasses. They're totally creepy." He looked more closely at his big brother. "You really don't look so great, Bri." "I don't feel so great," Brian said truthfully. "I think I'll lie down." "Well, I'll wait for you a while, see if you feel any better. I'll be watching cartoons on Channel 56. Come on down if you feel better." Sean shook the quarters in his cupped hands. "I will," Brian said, and closed his door softly as his little brother walked away. But he hadn't felt any better,
As the day drew on, he just went on feeling cloudier, worse and worse. He thought of Mr. Gaunt. He thought of Sandy Koufax. He thought of that glaring newspaper headline, "Murderous Spat Leaves Two Women Dead in Castle Rock." He thought of those pictures, familiar faces swimming up from clumps of black dots. Once he almost fell asleep, and then the little record player started up in his mother and father's bedroom. Mom was playing her scratchy Elvis 45s again. She had been doing it almost all weekend. Thoughts went whirling and rocking through Brian's head like bits of clutter caught up in a cyclone. Murderous spat. You know, they said that you was high class, but that was just a lie. It was a duel. Murderous. Nettie Cobb. The lady with the dog. You ain't never caught a rabbit. When you deal with me, you want to remember two things. Spat. Wilma Jerzyk, the lady with the sheets. Mr. Gaunt knows best. And you ain't no friend of mine. And the dealing isn't done until Mr. Gaunt says it's done. Around and around these thoughts went, a jumble of terror, guilt, and misery set to the beat of Elvis Presley's golden hits. By noon, Brian's stomach had begun to roil and knot. He hurried down to the bathroom at the end of the hall in his stocking feet, closed the door and vomited into the toilet bowl as quietly as he could. His mother didn't hear. She was still in her room, where Elvis was now telling her he wanted to be her teddy bear. As Brian walked slowly back to his room, feeling more miserable than ever, a horrible, haunting certainty came to him. His Sandy Koufax card was gone. Someone had stolen it last night while he slept. He had participated in a murder because of that card, and now it was gone. He broke into a run, almost slipped on the rug in the middle of his bedroom floor, and snatched his baseball card book from the top of the dresser. He turned through the pages with such terrified speed that he tore several loose from the ring binders. But the card, was still there, that narrow face looking out at him from beneath its plastic covering on the last page, still there, and Brian felt a great, miserable relief sweep through him. He slipped the card from its pocket, went over to the bed, and lay down with it in his hands. He didn't see how he could ever let go of it again. It was all he had gotten out of this nightmare, the only thing. He didn't like it anymore, but it was his. If he could have brought Nettie Cobb and Wilma Jerzyk back to life by burning it up, he would have been hunting for matches at once. Or so he really believed. But he couldn't bring them back, and since he couldn't, the thought of losing the card and having nothing at all was insupportable. So he held it in his hands and looked at the ceiling and listened to the dim sound of Elvis, who had moved on to Wooden Heart. It was not surprising that Sean had told him he looked bad. His face was white, his eyes huge and dark and listless, and his own heart felt pretty wooden now that he thought about it. Suddenly, a new thought, a really horrible thought, cut across the darkness inside his head with the affrighted, speeding brilliance of a comet. He had been seen! He sat bolt upright on his bed, staring at himself in the mirror on his closet door with horror. Bright green wrapper, bright red kerchief over a bunch of hair rollers. Miss Leberski. What's going on over there, boy? I don't know exactly. I think Mr. and Mrs. Jerzyk must be having an argument. Brian got off his bed and went over to the window, half expecting to see Sheriff Pangborn turning into the driveway in his police cruiser right this minute. He wasn't, but he would be coming soon, because when two women killed each other in a murderous spat, there was an investigation. Miss Leberski would be questioned, and she would say she had seen a boy at the Jerzyk's house. That boy, she would tell the sheriff, had been Brian Rusk. Downstairs, the telephone began to ring. His mother didn't pick it up, even though there was an extension in the bedroom. She just went on singing along with the music. At last he heard Sean answer, "Who is it, please?" Brian thought calmly, "He'll get it out of me. I can't lie, not to a policeman. I couldn't even lie to Mrs. LaRue about who broke the vase on her desk when she had to go down to the office that time. He'll get it out of me, and I'll go to jail for murder." That was when Brian Rusk first began to think of suicide. These thoughts were not lurid, not romantic. They were very calm, very rational. His father kept a shotgun in the garage, and at that moment the shotgun seemed to make perfect sense.
The shotgun seemed to be the answer to everything. "Brian! Telephone!"
"I don't want to talk to Stan," he yelled. "Tell him to call back tomorrow."
"It's not Stan," Sean called back. "It's a guy, a grown-up."
Large, icy hands seized Brian's heart and squeezed it. This was it. Sheriff Pangborn was on the phone.
"Brian, I have some questions to ask you. They're very serious questions. I'm afraid if you don't come right down to answer them, I'll have to come and get you. I'll have to come in my police car. Pretty soon your name is going to be in the paper, Brian, and your picture is going to be on TV, and all your friends will see it. Your mother and father will see it, too, and your little brother. And when they show the picture, the man on the news will say, 'This is Brian Rusk, the boy who helped murder Wilma Jerzyk and Nettie Cobb.'"
"Who is it?"
he called downstairs in a shrieking little voice.
"I don't know."
Sean had been torn away from the Transformers and sounded irritated.
"I think he said his name was Crowfix, something like that."
"Crowfix?" Brian stood in the doorway, his heart thumping in his chest. Two big clown spots of color now burned in his pallid face. Not Crowfix. Koufax. Sandy Koufax had called him on the phone, except Brian had a pretty good idea of who it really was. He went down the stairs on leaden feet. The telephone handset seemed to weigh at least 500 pounds.
"Hello, Brian," Mr. Gaunt said softly.
"Hello,"
Brian said in the same shrieky little voice. "You don't have a thing to worry about," Mr. Gaunt said. "If Mrs. Mislabursky had seen you throw those rocks, she wouldn't have asked you what was going on over there, now would she?"
"How do you know about that?"
Brian again felt like throwing up. "That doesn't matter. What matters is that you did the right thing, Brian. Exactly the right thing. You said you thought Mr. and Mrs. Jerzyk were having an argument. If the police do find you, they'll just think you heard the person who was throwing the rocks. They'll think you didn't see him because he was behind the house." Brian looked through the archway into the TV room to make sure Sean wasn't snooping. He wasn't. He was sitting cross-legged in front of the TV with a bag of microwave popcorn in his lap.
"I can't lie," he whispered into the telephone. "I always get caught out when I lie."
"Not this time, Brian," Mr. Gaunt said. "This time you're going to do it like a champ." And the most horrible thing of all was that Brian thought Mr. Gaunt knew best about this, too. While her older son was thinking of suicide and then dickering in a desperate, quiet whisper with Mr. Gaunt, Cora Rusk was dancing quietly around her bedroom in her housecoat. Except, it wasn't her bedroom. When she put on the sunglasses Mr. Gaunt had sold her, she was in Graceland. She danced through fabulous rooms which smelled of pine saw and fried food, rooms where the only sounds were the quiet hum of air conditioners. Only a few of the windows at Graceland actually opened. Many were nailed shut, and all were shaded. The whisper of her feet on deep pile rugs and the sound of Elvis singing "My Wish Came True" in his haunting, pleading voice. She danced beneath the huge chandelier of French crystal in the dining room and past the trademark stained glass peacocks. She trailed her hands across the rich blue velvet drapes. The furniture was French provincial. The walls were blood red. The scene changed like a slow dissolve in a movie, and Cora found herself in the basement den. There were racks of animal horns on one wall and columns of framed gold records on another. Blank TV screens bulged from a third wall. Behind the long curved bar were shelves stocked with Gatorade, orange, lime, lemon flavors. The record changer on her old portable phonograph with the picture of the king on its vinyl cover clicked. Another 45 dropped down. Elvis began to sing "Blue Hawaii," and Cora hula-hooled into the jungle room with its frowning tiki gods, the couch with the gargoyle armrests, the mirror with its lacy frame of feathers plucked from the breasts of living pheasants. She danced. With the sunglasses she had purchased in Needful Things masking her eyes, she danced. She danced at Graceland while her son crept back upstairs and lay down on his bed again and looked at the narrow face of Sandy Koufax and thought about alibis and shotguns. Castle Rock Elementary School was a frowning pile of red brick standing between the post office and the library, a holdover from the time when the town's elders didn't feel entirely comfortable with the school unless it looked like a reformatory. This one had been built in 1926 and filled that particular bill admirably. Each year, the town got a little closer to deciding to build a new one, one with actual windows instead of loopholes, and a playground that didn't look so much like a penitentiary exercise yard, and classrooms that actually stayed warm in the winter. Sally Ratcliffe's speech therapy room was an afterthought in the basement, tucked away between the furnace room and the supply closet, with its stacks of paper towels, chalk, Gin and Company textbooks, and barrels of fragrant red sawdust. With her teacher's desk and six smaller pupil desks in the room, there was barely enough space to turn around, but Sally had tried to make the place as cheery as possible just the same. She knew that most kids who were tapped for speech therapy, the stutterers, the lispers, the dyslexics, the nasal blocks, found the experience a frightening, unhappy one. They were teased by their peers and closely questioned by their parents. There was no need for the environment to be unnecessarily grim on top of that. So there were two mobiles hanging from the dusty ceiling pipes, pictures of TV and rock stars on the walls, and a big Garfield poster on the door. The words in the balloon coming out of Garfield's mouth said, "If a cool cat like me can talk that trash, so can you." Her files were woefully behind, even though school had been in session for only 5 weeks. She had meant to spend the whole day updating them, but at 1:15, Sally gathered them all up, stuck them back into the file drawer they had come from, slammed it shut, and locked it. She told herself she was quitting early because the day was too nice to spend cooped up in this basement room, even with the furnace mercifully silent for a change. This wasn't entirely the truth, however. She had very definite plans for this afternoon. She wanted to go home. She wanted to sit in her chair by the window with the sun flooding into her lap, and she wanted to meditate upon the fabulous splinter of wood she had bought in Needful Things. She had become more and more sure that the splinter was an authentic miracle, one of the small divine treasures God had scattered around the earth for his faithful to find. Holding it was like being refreshed by a dipper of well water on a hot day. Holding it was like being fed when you are hungry. Holding it was, well, holding it was ecstasy. And something had been nagging at her as well. She had put the splinter in the bottom drawer of her bedroom dresser, beneath her underwear, and she had been careful to lock the house when she went out. But she had a terrible, nagging feeling that someone might break in and steal the relic, holy relic. Splinter. She knew it didn't make much sense. What robber would want to steal an old gray piece of wood, even if he found it? But if the robber happened to touch it, if those sounds and images filled his head as they filled hers every time she closed the splinter in her small fist, well... So, she'd go home. She'd change into shorts and a halter and spend an hour or so in quiet exaltation. Meditation. Feeling the floor beneath her turn into a deck which heaved slowly up and down, listening to the animals moo and low and baa, feeling the light of a different sun, waiting for the magic moment. She was sure it would come if she held the splinter long enough, if she remained very, very quiet and very, very prayerful. When the bow of the huge lumbering boat should come to rest on the mountaintop with a low grinding sound. She did not know why God had seen fit to bless her, of all the world's faithful, with this bright and shining miracle. But since he had, Sally meant to experience it as fully and as completely as she could. She went out the side door and crossed the playground to the faculty parking lot, a tall, pretty young woman with darkish blonde hair and long legs. There was a good deal of talk about those legs in the barber shop. When Sally Ratcliffe went strolling by in her sensible low heels, usually with her purse in one hand and her Bible, stuffed with tracts, in the other. "Christ, that woman's got legs right up to her chin," Bobby Duga said once.
Don't let him worry you, Charlie Fortin replied. You ain't never gonna feel him wrapped around your ass. She belongs to Jesus and Lester Pratt, in that order.
The barbershop had exploded into hearty male laughter on the day when Charlie had gotten that one, a genuine knee slapper, off. And outside, Sally Ratcliffe had walked along on her way to Reverend Rose's Thursday evening Bible study for young adults, unknowing, uncaring, wrapped securely in her own cheerful innocence and virtue. No jokes were made about Sally's legs or Sally's anything if Lester Pratt happened to be in the clip joint, and he went there at least once every 3 weeks to have the bristles of his crew cut sharpened. It was clear to most of those in town who cared about such things that he believed Sally farted perfume and shit petunias, and you didn't argue about such things with a man who was put together like Lester. He was an amiable enough guy, but on the subjects of God and Sally Ratcliffe he was always dead serious, and a man like Lester could pull off your arms and legs before putting them back on in new and interesting ways if he wanted to. He and Sally had had some pretty hot sessions, but they had never gone all the way. Lester usually returned home after these sessions in a state of total discomposure, his brain bursting with joy and his balls bursting with frustrated jizz, dreaming of the night, not too far away now, when he wouldn't have to stop. He sometimes wondered if he might not drown her the first time they actually did it. Sally was also looking forward to marriage and an end to sexual frustration, although these last few days, Lester's embraces had seemed a little less important to her. She had debated telling him about the splinter of wood from the Holy Land she had purchased at Needful Things, the splinter with a miracle inside it, and in the end, she hadn't. She would, of course. Miracles should be shared. It was undoubtedly a sin not to share them. But she had been surprised, and a little dismayed, by the feeling of jealous possessiveness which rose up in her each time she thought of showing Lester the splinter and inviting him to hold it. No! An angry, childish voice had cried out the first time she had considered this. No, it's mine. It wouldn't mean as much to him as it does to me. It couldn't. The day would come when she would share it with him, just as the day would come when she would share her body with him. But it was not time for either of those things to happen yet. This hot October day belonged strictly to her. There were only a few cars in the faculty lot, and Lester's Mustang was the newest and nicest of them. She'd been having lots of problems with her own car. Something in the drivetrain kept breaking down, but that was no real problem. When she had called Les this morning and asked if she could have his car yet again, she'd only returned it after a 6-day loan at noon the day before, he agreed to drive it over right away. He could jog back, he said, and later he and a bunch of the guys were going to play touch football. She guessed he would have insisted that she take the car even if he had needed it, and that seemed perfectly all right to her. She was aware, in a vague, unfocused way that was the result of intuition rather than experience, that Les would jump through hoops of fire if she asked him to, and this established a chain of adoration which she accepted with naive complacency. Les worshipped her. They both worshipped God. Everything was as it should be, world without end. Amen. She slipped into the Mustang, and as she turned to put her purse on the console, her eye happened on something white sticking out from beneath the passenger seat. It looked like an envelope. She bent over and plucked it up, thinking how odd it was to find such a thing in the Mustang. Les usually kept his car as scrupulously neat as his person. There was one word on the front of the envelope, but it gave Sally Ratcliffe a nasty little jolt. The word was Lovey, written in lightly flowing script. Feminine script. She turned it over. Nothing written on the back, and the envelope was sealed. Lovey? Sally asked doubtfully, and suddenly realized she was sitting in Lester's car with all the windows still rolled up, sweating like mad. She started the engine, rolled down the driver's window, then leaned across the console to roll down the passenger window. She seemed to catch a faint whiff of perfume as she did it. If so, it wasn't hers. She didn't wear perfume, or makeup either. Her religion taught her that such things were the tools of harlots, and besides, she didn't need them. It wasn't perfume anyway, just the last of the honeysuckle growing along the playground fence. That's all you smelled. Lovey? She said again, looking at the envelope. The envelope said nothing. It just lay there, smugly in her hands. She fluttered her fingers over it, then bent it back and forth. There was a piece of paper in there, she thought, at least one, and something else, too. The something else felt like it might be a photograph. She held the envelope up to the windshield, but that was no good. The sun was going the other way now. After a moment's debate, she got out of the car and held the envelope up in front of the sun. She could only make out a light rectangle, the letter, she thought, and a darker square shape that was probably an enclosed photo from Lovey, whoever had sent Les the letter. Except, of course, it hadn't been sent. Not through the mails, anyway. There was no stamp, no address. Just that one troubling word. It hadn't been opened, either, which meant... what? That someone had slipped it into Lester's Mustang while Sally had been working on her files? That might be. It might also mean that someone had slipped it into the car last night, even yesterday, and Lester hadn't seen it. After all, only a corner had been sticking out. It might have slid forward a little from its place under the seat while she had been driving to school this morning. "Hi, Miss Ratcliffe," someone called. Sally jerked the envelope down and hid it in the folds of her skirt. Her heart bumped guiltily. It was little Billy Marchant cutting across the playground with his skateboard under his arm. Sally waved to him and then got quickly back into the car. Her face felt hot. She was blushing. It was silly. No, crazy. But she was behaving almost as if Billy had caught her doing something she shouldn't. Well, weren't you? Weren't you trying to peek at a letter that isn't yours? She felt the first twinges of jealousy then. Maybe it was hers. A lot of people in Castle Rock knew she had been driving Lester's car as much as she had been driving her own these past few weeks. And even if it wasn't hers, Lester Pratt was. Hadn't she just been thinking, with the solid, pleasant complacency which only Christian women who are young and pretty feel so exquisitely, that he would jump through hoops of fire for her? Lovey. No one had left that envelope for her, she was sure of that much. She didn't have any women friends who called her sweetheart or darling or lovey. It had been left for Lester, and... the solution suddenly struck her, and she collapsed against the powder-blue bucket seat with a little sigh of relief. Lester taught phys ed at Castle Rock High. He only had the boys, of course, but lots of girls, young girls, impressionable girls, saw him every day, and Les was a good-looking young man. Some little high school girl with a crush slipped a note into his car. That's all it is. She didn't even dare leave it on the dashboard where he would see it right away. "He wouldn't mind if I opened it," Sally said aloud, and tore off the end of the envelope in a neat strip which she put in the ashtray where no cigarette had ever been parked. "We'll have a good laugh about it tonight." She tilted the envelope, and a Kodak print fell out into her hand. She saw it, and her heart stuttered to a stop for a moment. Then she gasped. Bright red suffused her cheeks, and her hand covered her mouth, which had pursed itself into a small, shocked O of dismay. Sally had never been in the Mellow Tiger, so she didn't know that was the background, but she wasn't a total innocent. She had watched enough TV to know a bar when she saw one. The photo showed a man and a woman sitting at a table in what appeared to be one corner, a cozy corner, her mind insisted on calling it, of a large room. There was a pitcher of beer and two Pilsner glasses on the table. Other people were sitting at other tables behind and around them. In the background was a dance floor. The man and the woman were kissing. She was wearing a sparkly sweater top which left her midriff exposed and a skirt of what appeared to be white linen, a very short skirt. One of the man's hands pressed familiarly against the skin of her waist. The other was actually under her skirt, pushing it up even further. Sally could see the blur of the woman's panties. "That little chippy," Sally thought with angry dismay. The man's back was to the photographer. Sally could make out only his chin and one ear. But she could see that he was very muscular and that his black hair was mown into a rigorously short crew cut. He was wearing a blue T-shirt, what the school kids called a muscle shirt, and blue sweatpants with a white stripe on the side. Lester. Lester exploring the landscape under that chippy skirt. "No," her mind proclaimed in panicky denial. "It can't be him. Lester doesn't go out to bars. He doesn't even drink. And he'd never kiss another woman because he loves me. I know he does because..."
Because he says so. Her voice, dull and listless, was shocking to her own ears. She wanted to crumple the picture up and throw it out of the car, but she couldn't do that. Someone might find it if she did, and what would that someone think? She bent over the photograph again, studying it with jealous, intent eyes. The man's face blocked most of the woman's, but Sally could see the line of her brow, the corner of one eye, her left cheek, and the line of her jaw. More important, she could see how the woman's dark hair was cut, in a shag with bangs feathered across the forehead. Judy Libby had dark hair, and Judy Libby had it cut in a shag with bangs feathered across the forehead. You're wrong. No, worse than that, you're crazy. Les broke up with Judy when she left the church, and then she went away, to Portland or Boston or someplace like that. This is someone's twisted, mean idea of a joke. You know Les would never... But did she know? Did she really? All of her former complacency now rose up to mock her, and a voice which she had never heard before today suddenly spoke up from some deep chamber of her heart. The trust of the innocent is the liar's most useful tool. It didn't have to be Judy, though. It didn't have to be Lester, either. After all, you couldn't really tell who people were when they were kissing, could you? You couldn't even tell for sure at the movies if you came in late, not even if they were two famous stars. You had to wait until they stopped and looked at the camera again. This was no movie, the new voice assured her. This was real life. And if it isn't them, what was that envelope doing in this car? Now her eyes fixed upon the woman's right hand, which was pressed lightly against Lester's, her boyfriend's, neck. She had long, shaped nails painted with some dark polish. Judy Libby had nails like that. Sally remembered that she hadn't been at all surprised when Judy stopped coming to church. A girl with fingernails like that, she remembered thinking, has got a lot more than the Lord of Hosts on her mind. All right, so it's probably Judy Libby. That doesn't mean it's Lester with her. This could just be her nasty way of getting back at both of us because Lester dropped her when he finally realized she was about as Christian as Judas Iscariot. After all, lots of men have crew cuts, and any man can put on a blue T-shirt and a pair of pants with white coach stripes running up the sides. Then her eye happened upon something else, and her heart suddenly seemed to fill up with lead shot. The man was wearing a wristwatch, the digital kind. She recognized it, even though it wasn't in perfect focus. She ought to have recognized it. Hadn't she given it to Lester herself for his birthday last month? It could be a coincidence, her mind insisted feebly. It was only a Seiko. That's all I could afford. Anyone could have a watch like that. But the new voice laughed raucously, despairingly. The new voice wanted to know who she thought she was kidding. And there was more. She couldn't see the hand under the girl's skirt, thank God for small favors, but she could see the arm to which it was attached. There were two large moles on that arm, just below the elbow. They almost touched, making a shape like a figure eight. How often had she run her finger lovingly over those very same moles as she and Lester sat on the porch swing? How often had she kissed them lovingly as he caressed her breasts, armored in a heavy JCPenney bra carefully selected for just such conflicts of love on the back porch, and panted terms of endearment and promises of unflagging loyalty in her ear. It was Lester, all right. A watch could be put on and taken off, but moles couldn't be. A snatch of an old disco song occurred to her. Bad girls, toot toot, beep beep. Chippy, chippy, chippy! She hissed at the picture in a sudden, vicious undertone. How could he have gone back to her? How? Maybe, the voice said, because she lets him do what you won't. Her breast rose sharply. A hissing little gasp of dismay tore over her teeth and down her throat. But they're in a bar! Lester doesn't... Then she realized that was very much a secondary consideration. If Lester was seeing Judy, if he was lying about that, a lie about whether or not he drank beer wasn't very important, was it? Sally put the photograph aside with a shaking hand and pawed out of the envelope the folded note which accompanied it. It was on a single sheet of peach-colored stationery with a deckle edge. Some light smell, dusty and sweet, came from it when she took it out.
Sally held it to her nose and inhaled deeply.
Chippy!
She cried in a hoarse, agonized undertone. If Judy Libby had appeared in front of her at that moment, Sally would have attacked her with her own nails, sensibly short though they were. She wished Judy were. She wished Lester were, too. It would be a while before he played any more touch football after she got through with him. Quite a while. She unfolded the note. It was short, the words written in the rolling Palmer method hand of a schoolgirl. Darling Les, Felicia took this when we were at the Tiger the other night. She said she ought to use it to blackmail us, but she was only teasing. She gave it to me, and I am giving it to you as a souvenir of our big night. It was terribly naughty of you to put your hand under my skirt like that, right out in public, but it got me so hot. Besides, you are so strong. The more I looked at it, the more hot it started to make me. If you look close, you can see my underwear. It's a good thing Felicia wasn't around later when I wasn't wearing any. I will see you soon. In the meantime, keep this picture in remembrance of me. I will be thinking of you and your big thing. I better stop now before I get any hotter, or I'll have to do something naughty. And please stop worrying about you-know-who. She is too busy going steady with Jesus to worry about us. Your Judy. Sally sat behind the wheel of Lester's Mustang for almost half an hour, reading this note again and again, her mind and her emotions in a stew of anger, jealousy, and hurt. There was also an undertone of sexual excitement in her thoughts and feelings, but this was something she would never have admitted to anyone, least of all herself. The stupid slut doesn't even know how to spell two, she thought. Her eyes kept finding new phrases to fix upon. Most of them were the ones which had been capitalized. Our big night. Terribly naughty. So hot. So strong. Your big thing. But the phrase she kept returning to, the one which fed her rage most successfully, was that blasphemous perversion of the communion ritual. Keep this picture in remembrance of me. Obscene images rose in Sally's mind, unbidden. Lester's mouth closing on one of Judy Libby's nipples while she crooned, "Take, drink ye all of this in remembrance of me." Lester on his knees between Judy Libby's spread legs while she told him to take, "Eat this in remembrance of me." She crumpled the peach-colored sheet of paper into a ball and threw it onto the floor of the car. She sat bolt upright behind the wheel, breathing hard, her hair fuzzed out in sweaty tangles. She had been running her free hand distractedly through it as she studied the note. Then she bent, picked it up, smoothed it out, and stuffed both it and the photograph back into the envelope. Her hands were shaking so badly she had to try three times to get it in, and when she finally did, she tore the envelope halfway down the side. "Chippy!" she cried again, and burst into tears. The tears were hot. They burned like acid. "Bitch! And you! You! Lying bastard!" She jammed the key into the ignition. The Mustang awoke with a roar that sounded as angry as she felt. She dropped the gear shift into drive and tore out of the faculty parking lot in a cloud of blue smoke and a wailing shriek of burned rubber. Billy Marchant, who was practicing nosies on his skateboard across the playground, looked up in surprise. She was in her bedroom 15 minutes later, digging through her underwear, looking for the splinter and not finding